I've had a bit of laryngitis. It's not as painful as it sounds. So remember Mark Twain's comment about Richard Wagner's music. It's not as bad as it sounds. So, I'm Larry Rasmussen. This is a series on Earth Honoring Faith. And we began yesterday by looking at one of the deep traditions that are shared across religions, namely notions of the simple life or asceticism, and asked how that might speak to global consumerism as one of the forces which on balance has become a source of degradation of planetary health. So what I'm trying to do this week is look at a series of shared deep religious traditions and how they might be in conversation with forces that are bearing down hard on us and are of our own making. And tomorrow it'll be mysticism and alienation, our alienation from much of the rest of nature. On Thursday it'll be prophetic liberative traditions across religions and their address of oppression, including oppression of the land. And on Friday it'll be the wisdom traditions, which are pan-religious and pan-human, and how that speaks to certain follies, I think, that we will have to call them. But today it's the sacred and the commodified. In some ways there are some pretty strong continuities between yesterday's focus on consumerism and today's focus on the fact that we live with an economic, socioeconomic order that commodifies most everything in nature for the sake of market exchange. And I want us to ask what kind of a sacramental ethic would look like, ask what the nature of a commodity ethic that we live by looks like, and then what the questions are that arise. Just a comment about yesterday. We talked a little bit about how it was that formal government policy proposed, quote, the propensity to consume as the official policy, and then helped put things in place for that, all for very good reasons. The Depression, World War II, you had people ruined nations in Asia and Europe. You had a workforce coming back from the wars that needed work. You had families that wanted to get started. So all for very good reason, we went to a socioeconomic policy that emphasized production. And Keynesian economics became the way in which that was done. The consumerist economy became known as the mature economy in the stages of economic growth. So that's just a kind of review. It continues and now has taken on the form of commodifying almost all things for the market. And of course, along with that goes advertising budgets, which now far exceed the budgets for public education. And we'll get into this a little bit. I think before we talk about the nature of a sacramental universe or a notion that of the sacred as the place where religious communities might find a meeting ground, we'll take a look at some transitions that are necessary in order to move from the industrial technological civilization to ecological civilization. I put on the board, I didn't do it this time, the premise for this whole series, namely that planetary health is primary and human well-being is derivative. But we are now in the process, because of the continuation of the industrial technological paradigm, we're in the process of degrading planetary health, of the planetary health upon which we utterly depend for our own well-being. You can't invert that. You can't say human well-being is primary and the planetary health is derivative. It doesn't work. Not when you're on top of the food chain, for sure. But we know pretty well where we must go. And that's what I'm going to outline as six transitions in this movement from industrial to ecological. This is the work of generations, so these are long-haul transitions. We will need to have a perspectival transition in which we understand ourselves as a species among species. The Industrial Revolution let us think that it was, I don't know if it works, Alan, I think there's a kind of species apartheid consciousness that the Industrial Revolution let us engage in. We think we as a species could somehow develop, quotation marks, apart from attention to other species, as white South Africans thought that they could be a segregated. So we think we could be a kind of segregated species. In fact, human beings don't really think of themselves as a species among species, with the exception of having dominion over the rest. That's the way in which we usually think of ourselves in species terms. So we need some kind of perspectival transition in which we understand ourselves as a species among species, no longer inhabiting the same planet that Homo sapiens have known for a very long time. It's a tough new place. Entering a new geological age, the Anthropocene. This altered perspective probably needs to include a certain re-enchantment of the world. I'm using Max Weber's terms now. He said the Industrial Revolution brought a disenchantment of the world. The sacred was leached from the everyday. Mystery was when nature was no longer the source of mystery, wonder, and the sacred. It was a disenchanted world. And now the task is probably one where a re-enchantment is due. And we'll talk about the sacred in that connection. Re-enchantment restores nature, the rest of nature, we are nature, but restores the rest of nature to human consciousness and feeling. Nature is a community of subjects rather than a collection of objects. Nature as the bearer of mystery and spirit, as the ethos of the cosmos itself, the womb of all of the life that we will ever know. Another transition that we know we must make is an economic transition in which economics and ecology merge so as to comprise economics. That is to say, all human economic activity has to happen within the ecological limits of nature's economy, of which it's part. And it has to pursue this threefold agenda of economics, namely production, relatively equitable distribution, and ecological regenerativity. We use the word sustainability. It's not a very good one, because we don't want to sustain what we have. It's got to be better than that. It's ecological regenerativity. So how do you get an economic order that addresses issues of production, relatively equitable distribution, and ecological regenerativity? How do you get an economic order in which all economic policy takes into account the first law of economics, which is preservation of the earth economy? Then a demographic transition. I mentioned the article in The Onion, which reported that scientists say the planet can sustain 3 billion human beings. We're now just past 7. So we've got to get rid of 4 billion human beings. Then the article says, now, how do you want to go about doing this? Well, I mean, that's all Onion, tongue-in-cheek stuff. But we do have to undergo a demographic transition in which human population levels off or slowly declines, and the negative per-person impact on the rest of nature gives way to a mutual enhancement of human beings with the rest of life. And it's amazing to me, we had theme vespers last night on water, and the theme this summer is where the river flows, life abounds. Saw the movie, some of you tapped the documentary. I did a study of some of the studies of water, and one of the more impressive ones was from IBM. And IBM had commissioned research around the world to find out what the best water practices were, and then tallied them, and it's a very helpful piece. Got to the end, and it said, well, there really isn't a water crisis. This is how much fresh water we have. This is the total number of human beings. Take the total number of human beings into the total amount of fresh water. And it didn't look like a crisis. There wasn't a single other critter that was even taken into consideration. It was an utterly, the only critters that count were human beings, as if no other critter needed water. I mean, it's quite amazing how tunnel-minded we can be on these matters. So, a demographic transition where the population levels off, which it will do, slowly declines. Polity transition, in which I think if we stay with democratic capitalism, I don't know that we can, because I'm not sure capitalism is compatible with nature's economy. It hasn't been thus far, let's put it that way. But if we stay with it, then the shift needs to be from a society that fosters virtually unrestricted liberty to acquire and enjoy wealth, in which the right to property and its uses is more basic than the role of government as an equalizing force across society. You have to shift from that to a society that fosters the common good through a process of democratizing social, economic, and political power, and in doing it in such a way that the primary goods of the commons themselves, earth, air, fire, and water, that their health is attended to. You can't have a human common good if you don't attend to the goods of the commons and what they require for their own regeneration and renewal on their own terms. Then a policy transition in which policies are as integrated as nature itself. Climate change, poverty issues, energy, food, water are all interlaced in nature's economy and in the human economy that's a part of it. And our policies need to mirror this kind of systemic character of nature's own integral functioning. The World Council of Churches had it right in 1983 on justice, peace, integrity of creation theme. The integral functioning of planetary systems has to be the base point for undertaking policies that affect one or other of the elements of that integral functioning. So that human technologies are congruent with the technologies of the natural world. That's the point. Then we will probably also need a religious and moral transition in which, because planetary health is primary and human well-being is derivative, the center of Christian and other religious ethics shifts. It isn't the case with all of the religions, but shifts from the ego to the ecosphere, from an understanding of the moral universe as about human beings only, to an understanding of the ecosphere as the boundary of the moral universe, the biotic and the abiotic world together. Planet keeping then becomes the common calling of all religions at the same moment that this moral framework stretches from a kind of fixation on a segregated human species and includes now responsibility for the societal, the political, and the geophysical. We haven't taken the primal elements, earth, air, fire, or water, and asked what moral claims they impose upon us. We haven't really considered that. Okay. If that is one tallying of transitions that we will need to undertake, then what are the resources among the world's religions that might make a contribution to this collective task of generations? And that's where I'm proposing that we take the deep traditions that show up cross-culturally and across time. They're speaking to something in the human spirit, something profound. There's a reason why sacramentalism, mysticism, prophetic liberative streams, wisdom, asceticism, there's a reason why they keep coming back again and again, and wide variety of them, but they never stay dead, even when they die out in some place or another, neither within religious traditions or across them. And if that's the case, maybe they have something profound to say. Today I want to ask whether our notions of the sacred can speak to the dominance of our way of life that commodifies all things. Now the last item by way of introduction is to say that none of these deep traditions is unsullied. None of them, we're not retrieving some pure form here. We have to hold the moral plumb line to all of them. And the moral plumb line in this case is one which asks, are the traditions as they are retrieved earth-honoring? Are they earth-healing? We measure them by whether or not they contribute to planetary health, including the health of the soil, the water, the air, fire, energy, and so on. So there's probably, but they're living traditions, so they can change, and they do change. Might they, if they do not already, are not already earth-honoring, become earth-honoring and earth-healing? So asceticism, which has sometimes been misogynist, sometimes it's been earth-denying, has also been some very earth-honoring asceticism. The same kind of question has to go to notions of the sacred. Yesterday I started out with on consumerism, and we got so wound tied up in it and had fun singing about it with Linda and Sophie. And we didn't much get to asceticism. Today I'm going to start with the sacred and then go to commodification. I put some kind of formal definitions up here. It's not easy for you to read them, perhaps, so let me read them out. First of all, is a quotation from N. Scott Momaday. The most important thing for the planet is to reinvent the sacred. And I think I want to pose as the question for our discussion of what does that mean? And what kind of reinvention is needed? One understanding, or an understanding of the sacred that pretty much covers a lot of religions, is that the sacred refers to material reality, nature. Material reality bears a value that humans share and name, but do not bestow. A value inclusive of all that is. In the language of the Hebrew Bible, creation is deemed good and very good. That's an important understanding of the sacred. The themes of a sacred universe are, this is a always underscored, life is a gift. A gift we receive, and we are a part of that gift. But it is a gift, and it's the medium of grace, and it's this life of gratitude is renewed in worship. So the sacred has a focus on the liturgical and on worship that some of the other traditions that we'll talk about don't carry with that kind of essential strength. Another theme of the sacred is that the universe is not a collection of objects. The universe is a communion of subjects. A formulation is Thomas Berry's. It essentially says that everything is webbed together, that we are born to belonging, and in some sense, everything is born to belonging. H. Richard Niebuhr says, in this notion of a sacramental or a sacred universe, the neighbor is all that participates in being. Not just human beings, but all that participates in being is the neighbor. The sacramental principle is life-giving grace is present to and through creation as God's own abiding presence. Sometimes that's called panentheism, not pantheism, but panentheism. Pan is the Greek for all, and in theism, God. Everything is in God. God is in all things. We live and move and have our being in God. All things live and move and have their being in God. So creation or nature is God's abode, is where the spirit that animates it is at home. I'm going to use a few examples from water. I did a session last week on the wonder of water, and I won't be going back to that, but because the summer theme is on water, and it's one of the primal elements, what would it be like to tell the story of faith as the story of water, or from, if you will, the perspective of water? Just listen to what we sang at Vespers. This is the story of faith as told by water. Crashing waters at creation, ordered by the Spirit's breath, first to witness day's beginning from the brightness of night's death. Parting water stood and trembled as the captives passed on through, washing off the chains of bondage, channeled to a life made new. Cleansing water, once at Jordan, closed around the one foretold, open to reveal the glory ever new and ever old. Living water, never ending, quench the thirst and flood the soul. Wellspring, source of life eternal, drench our dryness, make us whole. Well, if we got in the habit of telling our stories as and the story of the life of faith from the point of view of the primal elements, as a story told by water, as a story told by soil, as a story told by breath, breath of life, as a story told by fire, you know, what shape then, what kind of conversation would ensue as a consequence of that? How would it shape our lives? And what would that mean for consumerism, commodification of all things, our alienation from much of the rest of the planet? Let me read a piece from Marilynne Robinson's Gilead. You may know this, but in Gilead, the old pastor is his his alien heart kind of beating out its mortality, captures memories in some letters to his young son. And this is one of them. "You and Tobias are hopping around in the sprinkler. The sprinkler is a magnificent invention because it exposes raindrops to sunshine. That does occur in nature, but it is rare. When I was in seminary, I used to go sometimes to the Baptists down at the river. It was something to see the preacher lifting the one who was being baptized up out of the water and the water pouring off the garments and the hair. It did look like a birth or a resurrection. For us, the water just heightens the touch of the pastor's hands on the sweet bones of the head, sort of like making an electrical connection. I've always loved to baptize people, though I have sometimes wished there were more shimmer and splash involved in the way we go about it. Well, but you two are dancing around in your iridescent little downpour, whooping and stomping as sane people ought to do when they encounter a thing so miraculous as water." This is what sane people ought to be doing, whooping and stomping in the presence of water.
Do you have a page number reference?
Yeah, well, I don't. I can get it for you. I just didn't bring the end notes along, but I can get it. There it is. Or another example using water of how things look when we view them through the lens of the sacred is an article that appeared in the New York Sunday Times entitled "Saving Souls and Salmon." And in this particular case, it was not far from here. Archbishop Alex Brunette was talking to the reporter from the New York Times. His name was Jim Robbins. And he took him to the baptismal font at St. James Cathedral in downtown Seattle. "The water isn't just sitting there," Archbishop Brunette said, pointing to its gentle movement. "We don't baptize people in stagnant water, but flowing water, water that's alive. The waters of baptism," end of quote. "The waters of baptism, namely, of life, namely baptism, and the waters of life, in this case the Columbia River, and its salmon, formed the connection. For the Archbishop, that connection was sacramental. Saving souls and saving salmon belong to the same universe. The Columbia River watershed, realities and possibilities, is what's called a bioregional pastoral letter. It was Roman Catholic bishops of Montana, Idaho, Washington, and Oregon, and British Columbia. A century of unbridled logging, mining, grazing, and dam building had left the Great River and its basin in rather dire straits. If you took its emblem, namely the salmon, as any measure, as of 2000, the annual run of an estimated 16 million salmon had dwindled to 700,000. I don't know where it is now, if it's come back or not, but it's a great fall off. But no less arresting is the name that the bishops gave this endangered watershed, namely a sacramental commons. We're trying to establish a sacredness in the world around us, the Archbishop explained to the Times writer. Establishing such sacredness assumes this leading tenet that material reality bears a value that human beings participate in and name but don't convey or confer. Such value is inclusive of all of being. Don Sampson, a Yakima Indian leader, chuckled in response to the bishop's letter. Perhaps God has spoken to the bishops, he said. I hope the Pope gets on board. In a more serious tone, he added, the church is being upfront in dispelling the myth of manifest destiny and dominion over the earth. That is refreshing and welcome. I once proposed at a conference that we quit baptizing until all of the world's water was safe for the children. Or that if we didn't quit baptizing, we would be very self-conscious that we were baptizing them with polluted waters. And I asked for a vote on it. We got one vote. That was mine. And this didn't go down well at all. But the point is to make a connection between a sacramental notion of waters and the literal waters of life. What is the connection between the waters of life of baptism and the waters of life of the irrigation ditch? Or another example from home, the name of Santa Fe where I live is La Ria Real de las Santa Fe de San Francisco de Asís, the Royal City of the Holy Faith, Santa Fe, of St. Francis of Assisi. But since nobody wants to write that on their return address, and just write Santa Fe. But the Indian Pueblo that was there before Santa Fe was settled in the late 1500s was actually two names, both of them lovely. Dancing Ground of the Sun and White Shell Water Place. And that kind of immediacy of a people with the primal elements and understanding themselves in terms of the primal elements is still reflected among Pueblo peoples. But Santa Fe also works nicely with St. Francis because for him, earth's sacred primal elements are siblings, brother, son, sister, moon, brothers, wind and air, sister, water, brother, fire, mother, earth, sister, bodily death. They're all siblings in his own little song of songs, the canticle of the sun. Okay, let's take just a few minutes and I'll switch now to the commodities, but let's do this inductively. Tell me what you know about commodities. Characterize the world of commodities.
Stuff.
Lots of stuff. Yeah.
It can be naturally, it can be a product of the earth, not just manufactured.
Yeah. Yes, sure. Extraction from the earth, salt, coal. What's the world of commodities?
The world of commodities is a world where nothing has value unless you can attach a price to it.
Yeah, the value is always human added value. It's until we've decided it's a valuable commodity, it might just be a rock. If it's ore,
then we create them.
And we train them, yeah.
Or collect and then train them.
Yeah. So it's human added value. Right. What else is true of the world of commodity?
Most instances of a commodity are identical to any other instance. Any barrel of light sweet crude is equal to any other barrel of light sweet crude.
Yeah. Okay. Did any of you see the documentary Tapped?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, last night. What else did you pick up from that that would tell you about the world of commodities? That was water as a commodity.
Money.
Yeah. Yeah. Follow the money. Yeah.
Is it finite?
Do you know whether it's finite? It's discrete, but does the commodity itself reflect its finiteness?
It's finite human manage. It's finiteness human manage.
Yeah. Right.
I didn't see it last night, but it seems to me that when you talk about commodification, that it's referring also to property that now is owned.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than some economies that are shared, about seeds and India, where things that were just given became commodified and stolen
from
people buying.
Yeah. In the case of seeds, then you have to buy them from someone who holds the patent for them. What do you know about the commodity that you have in your hand? What do you know about it? As you look at it, as you have a bottled water in your hand, what do you know about that water?
You paid money for it.
Yeah.
The bottle had to be manufactured in some way, shape, or form.
Yes.
Tied to Wall Street.
Okay.
It's separated.
You don't know, you know almost nothing. You know almost nothing about the commodity.
But I paid money for something that the sky freely gives me.
Yes.
So
this doesn't sound like a good deal. No, I mean, you don't know where it came from. Yeah. You don't know what the impact was on the land or the source or the people. You are, by virtue of that commodity, alienated from the other end of it. From the land, the people, the resources. You know almost nothing. There might be some ingredients on there, and it'll probably tell you some place of origin. It'll say made in, but it won't tell you where. Just as last night, some people may not have known that much of bottled water by companies, Nestle, Pepsi, Coke, is taken from public water sources. It's bottling water. You don't know what the energy cost is. Do you know that bottled water is 2,000 times more energy intensive than tap water? Peter Glick says you should imagine that each of those bottles is filled 1/4 with oil. You're drinking carbon emissions because of the manufacturing of the container that it's in, and then the distribution. It may have been traveled a long way. It's the nature of any commodity to be convenient. The word commodity comes from the Latin commodius, which translates as convenience. The whole purpose of a commodity, and the reason they're so attractive to us, is because it is convenient for us. It does not burden us with the responsibility for having to acquire that on our own, to do the farming or to do the pumping or to do whatever it is. A commodity is convenient for us without burdening us. But it removes all of the relationships that are involved in that commodity. Removes them from us. Yeah, Jen?
Well, I'd like to be in this area
put on top of the screen and drink.
Yeah.
And we cooked with it and everything.
Sure.
We can't do that now. We messed it up pretty good.
We better not do it. Yeah. There's a nice section in, let me find it here, if I can. Story of Rebecca at the Well. The biblical story of Rebecca at the Well illumines our real-world loss of what the sociologists call manifold engagement. With a commodity, we simplify the relationships of that, where that commodity, that good, that food maybe, or that source of energy, where it came from. We don't have manifold engagement with that world. The biblical story of Rebecca at the Well illumines our real-world loss of manifold engagement. When Rebecca went to the well, she found not only living water, but also companionship, news of the village, and her fiancé. These strands of her life were woven into a fabric that technology has divided and privatized into commodities. That's what Albert Borgman writes. Now, that's no argument for women as virtual property. It's no argument for the hardship and confinement of village life. So don't get me wrong here. But if you compare Rebecca at the well with a woman standing at the sink of the 11th floor of a Cleveland studio apartment, then the presence of things, Rebecca's community, is replaced with packaged goods in an engagement without a context. The engagement is an engagement, but it's a simplified one. It's not manifold. It's simplified in the way the industrial paradigm conveniently simplifies all nature for human betterment and convenience. If you took a lens of the sacred and water, or on food, for example, and compared it to food as a commodity, a TV dinner, you get a very different, two very different worlds. There's a Buddhist meditation in the presence of food that I like very much. In this food, I see clearly the entire universe supporting my existence. In this food, I see clearly the entire universe supporting my existence. And I think we need to nurture that kind of sense of belonging if we're not going to continue to treat nature as only it, as only object, as only material available to us for our convenience. How to do that? But the faith communities have resources. And they have lots of experience at this. But this relationship, if everything is commodity, then there's always a relationship. But this relationship is commercial, instrumental, and out of sight. I remember when our son was in school, he went for a while to a Waldorf school, and so we studied Rudolf Steiner's philosophy. And one of the main points that with the young ones was to teach them that actions have consequences. And so the little ones were taught to see, observe what followed from what they did, and to take responsibility for that, or share responsibility for that. What commodities let us adults do is not see the consequences of our actions. We don't have adult-like relationships when nature is commodified. We have actions and we have consequences. We don't see the connection between the actions and the consequences. consequences.
In Keynes.
What?
In Keynes economics, isn't the consequences passed on to the next generation?
How so?
He was asked about the future.
Yeah.
And how this is, and he says, well, in the future we're dead.
Yeah, we're all dead.
Yeah, that was his answer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Keynes was also the one who said, you know, for a while, fair must be foul and foul must be fair. That is, we've got an economy where we have to emphasize production or generate the jobs, and it will produce inequality. But for a while, and that's necessary. And our problem was that we never stopped.
Yeah.
And it didn't have a break, and it's continued to be that. There's a nice little play on some common words here that is rather interesting. The word company would seem to be a kind of contrasting word with commodity in that company means to break bread together. Pan is bread here, and come is come. So when you're having communion, you're breaking bread together. That's the meaning of company. A shared meal around a convivial table. We're having, my folks used to say, we're having company over. And that was a shared meal around the convivial table. And sometimes it was just lunch, but sometimes it was a real sacramental association as well. There was real sense of belonging and in keeping with the sacramental presence, life-giving grace present to and through creation as God's own abiding presence there. But the first definition of company in the New Oxford American Dictionary is a commercial business. Only thereafter comes an entry for company as the fact or condition of being with another or others, especially in a way that provides friendship and enjoyment. We're having company over. Thus do commerce and commodity regularly trump belonging and sacrament. Intentional or not, and they're not intending this. The people that wrote the dictionary actually reflect the non-sacramental place of commodified nature in modernity's alienated engagement with nature. Okay, we've got 15 minutes or so almost. How do we get this conversation going? How do we take a perspective of life as sacred and nature as the abode of God and bring that to bear on a world in which nature is commodified for market exchange? I think we sometimes do it quite well in many of our gatherings in worship. I think the Holden theme this summer will run like a river, flow like a river, and people will go away with a sense of their relationship to water and water in abundance. Did you notice this morning, Alan, after the prayers that arose like incense from the candles that the river started flowing in the village center? It was amazing. Yeah. And that also is real. So how do we bring this kind of experience of the sacred to the sort of transitions that we need to make?
I think some of the ways we treat the world is trying to buy something to replace an emptiness we feel.
Yeah.
And you know, you think of Christ's words, "I have come that they might have life and have it fully."
Yeah.
I think our faith can say, you know, I don't need to own this. I don't need
We've actually come to the point where, this is the happiness literature, but the studies of what makes for happiness by people's own self-definition, up to a certain point, you have to have more in order to be more. I mean, if you're desperately poor, you have to have more in order to be more. But after certain basic human needs are met, in terms of security, you've got a place to sleep, you got food on the table, you don't have to worry over the next meal. After that point, there isn't a correlation of increased owning of stuff and well-being. And now, in many places, we've actually gone the other side, where there's more anxiety, there are more diseases that are diseases that arrive with affluence. Yeah. So, in Philip Slater's little book, In Pursuit of Loneliness, he says, you know, we've arrived at the point where you got a separate room for each of the kids, might be a separate entertainment center or a TV or something in each of them. He said, it's actually the pursuit of loneliness. You depend on technology more and more and ask less and less of each other.
Who called it affluenza?
I'm not sure who did, but that's a notion. But
how an individual can make that decision and act on it. But what about countries?
Yeah, that's the point here. How do we make these transitions en masse? Mm-hmm. You know, as large groups. How did they become institutionalized? Not individual lifestyle choices, but systems and structures. How do we go about that? I mean, I'll give you one example where it's working very well. At home, the farmer's market is a place where the commodities, they're still commodities in the sense that they're for sale there as goods on the market. But you're buying from the farmers who produce them. You get a relationship with the farmers. The farmers often invite you to come to the farm, especially if you signed on for CSA, where you pay the farmer a subscription and get goods delivered each week from there. But they'll invite you out, and the kids can go for pony rides or whatever, and you can do some volunteer work. And I love contrasting, and somebody's making music at the farmer's market, and somebody else has put on some coffee and brought in some baked goods for those that want to have breakfast at the farmer's market. But I love the contrast between the farmer's market, because it's just buzz, buzz, buzz. And it's just chatter everywhere. And contrast that with the supermarket. How many conversations are being held by the people who are passing one another in the supermarket?
I had to stop to avoid a cart collision because the man in his 30s was walking.
A texting. Yeah,
with
sure.
His head down.
Yes. Yeah.
Actually, if you have a conversation in the supermarket, you can bottle up traffic.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the conversation you have in the supermarket is, have a great day, as you
you get the receipt.
Yeah, and then you get the receipt. Yeah. But the difference between those two worlds, the supermarket as a kind of exemplifying the commoditized world and the farmer's market, some of them, people at the farmer's market would call that an expression of a kind of sacred universe. In fact, at our farmer's market on the north, the handwriting is on the wall. And the handwriting is on the north wall of the farmer's market, and the handwriting is a sentence that somebody put up there from Wendell Berry to cherish the remains of the earth and pursue its, to cherish the remains of the earth and seek its renewal is our only hope of survival. And that kind of cherishing is what is associated with the sacred. It has a value that we share, but we do not create.
Our local CSA farm suffered a flood
2 years
ago.
Uh-huh. take the risks.
Right, and
with the farmer.
90% of the shareholders came back.
Yeah,
they bought the next year, even though they had lost.
Yeah.
They had lost the year before.
Yeah. But there you saw what the Waldorf kids were trying to learn. There's a connection between actions and consequences and the responsibility that goes along with it.
Now, if there was not a CSA,
yeah,
that farmer's done,
yeah,
because of that flood too. So he's not farming the next year, he's done.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there was a relationship that allowed for mutual survival too.
Yeah.
And there was something about that the other way, where the farmer's completely on his own, and if he suffers a catastrophic loss, then
yeah,
he needs to look for employment.
Yeah, that's why the subscription comes at the beginning of the year.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, Bill and then Donald.
Well, our farmer's market, I mean, I know those farmers, and it's still a commodity.
It is a commodity.
They're still subject to Wall Street and banks,
yeah,
those people that are bringing me that carrot.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they're strapped by that.
Yeah.
And unless you change what's behind them. What's supporting the farmers on their pocketbook side? They're not gonna. Commodity's a commodity.
It is, but it still makes a difference. And the banking system is another place where one can make changes. In the state of North Dakota, they actually have a state bank, and it allows them to do some things that the privatizing bank doesn't. And in Santa Fe, we're talking about putting together a bank for the city. So, but you're absolutely right to point to that's another set of institutions back here that matter, and that also have to change. John?
Larry, I would be interested in your perspective on what can be done, though, to take this on a bigger scale, because CSA,
yeah,
and farmers markets are not going to cut the mustard for the 300 plus million in the United States, the 707 billion plus in the world.
Yeah.
And I have struggled with, I know what I can do,
yeah,
but how do you get to the tipping point to use that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what I would be just interested in your perspective, and I know we're running out of time, so you only get 30 seconds.
Yes. we did a seminar at Ghost Ranch, which is in New Mexico. Food, glorious food, which is from Oliver, the Broadway play, The Eucharist and Your Food Shed. And we got together some people who work in, are experts in food, together with people who think about food and faith together, and people leading in worship. And one of the surprising things to me, Don, doesn't answer your question, one of the surprising things to me is that you actually have higher levels of production on smaller farms, more intensively farmed, than you do the big corporate farms of monocropping. But then the issue becomes, I mean, agribusiness will say you can't feed the world if you don't do it our way. Well, it's not because you can't produce enough food. You can. You can actually do more. The issue becomes, how do you then resettle from the city to the countryside? One thing that's happening now is a movement called the New Agrarians, which are mostly young people who want to resettle the land. And if we keep not finding jobs for you all, there'll be more of them. Our time is up, and we must.
Well, the Bible tells us, your heart is where your money is. It,
yeah,
has to be to solve the earth. So
yeah.
Farmers markets are not the whole solution, but
no.
You begin to create community,
yeah,
farmers.
Yeah.
You begin to flavor how people,
yeah, and it's. Yeah, exactly. It's a good place to sum. And it's not a commodity community. It's a different kind. Thanks, folks. We'll carry on.
Thank you.